Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ciao a tutti. How's that?
Beautiful.
Beautiful, thank you. Okay, ciao a tutti. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Spinster Princess Lady P, no relation to Master P. And purring in the background is FlixWise co-producer, Don Martin Kessler. Hey, Martin.
Don't worry, the eye patch is just for show.
Yeah. I suspected as much. And making his FlixWise debut is a man who knows how to properly rock some facial hair. Let's all welcome Count David Eves. Welcome, FlixWise.
Thank you for having me. Are my mutton chops well-groomed enough for this appearance?
Well, they're a little scruffy, but I think it works for you.
That's good. Yeah. So, what movie are we even talking about today?
It's The Leopard, David! The Leopard! I had to. Sorry.
Oh, jeez.
I know. unfortunately, we're not talking Bringing Up Baby, but we are going to talk Hollywood royalty and also the regular kind of royalty. For the 57th film on the Sight and Sound list, we have Burt Lancaster starring in Luchino Visconti's period drama Il Gatto Pardo? Huh? Maybe? El Gatto? El Gatto? Someone can fill us in. I should have looked this up.
Gatto is cat.
Gatto? That makes sense. Il Gatto Pardo. There you go. Someone took Italian. All right. Or as I will be referring to it, I will be referring to it as The Leopard, so don't worry. This three-hour epic, plus or minus 30 minutes, depending on which version you watch, is a triumph of detailed production design and elaborate costuming. But what's really going on underneath all the ornate detail? Well, here's a hint. Our second topic is favorite movies about the winds of change. We're going to talk about our favorite depictions of great cultural shifts and the resulting intergenerational conflicts. Then we'll remedy all the familial discord with a few final notes of positivity. Okay, guys, shall we dance?
I suppose.
If I
Let's
must.
Let's do this.
All right. First up, we have Luchino Visconti's 1963 Italian epic, The Leopard, which was adapted from Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa's novel of the same name. I'm so sorry, guys. The story is set in mid-19th century Sicily during the Second Italian War of Independence as General Garibaldi is sweeping through Italy in an attempt to liberate the country. And by liberate, I mean centralize the power of the Italian aristocracy under one powerful monarch. The Leopard, our main character from which the film derives its title, is a nickname of Don Fabrizio Corbera, played with quiet dignity by the one and only Burt Lancaster. Don Fabrizio is an aging Sicilian prince who stands to lose a great deal of power from Garibaldi's revolution. However, he decides to support it anyway, with the understanding that in order to preserve what's left of his crumbling democracy, he'll have to take measures which were once believed unconscionable by the punctilious defenders of the old order. Measures such as allowing his ambitious, charismatic young nephew, Tancredi, played by Alain Delon, to marry a young woman named Angelica, played by Claudia Cardinale, or Claudia Cardinale, depending on who you ask. Claudia, why don't you call us up and tell us? Whose father... Angelica's father rose up from poverty through misbegotten means. In other words, he came by his wealth through swindling and money grabbing as opposed to the dignity of inheritance or birthright. And therefore, she would have been unworthy. But in other times, she would have been unworthy. But the prince makes these concessions, knowing that it is the only means by which he can ensure that his family will enjoy the influence and stature that they have held for centuries. All of these breaks of tradition tear at our dear prince's heart. By the end, he's suffering such chest pain that the viewer is left to believe that he has only moments left to live after the screen fades to black. As I mentioned in the opening, this film was initially released in 1963, in a period of great economic and social change in Italy. It bears recognizing that there might just be some ways in which the story, set in the 1860s, reflects some of the tumult of the 1960s. But how much does the film's message still reverberate today? If the prince's motto holds true, things will have to change in order that they stay the same. The themes of this film should be as resonant as ever. But I guess we'll have to do a quick poll and talk about it. What do you guys think? Still ring true today? Martin, should we start with you?
If it still rings true today?
Sure.
I think so. Like, I think there are sort of eternal themes that come out of this, like, very specifically created presentation of an era. You know, I think it's sort of an eternal generational conflict of the older generation being like, oh, you young kids are going to ruin the world, and the young kids being like, oh, you old people ruin the world.
Yep.
You know, I think that's it goes all the way back. You find like 3,000-year-old writings of people saying, oh, these kids are horrible. They're not the same.
Yep. But,
the film itself, like, for a long stretch, I kind of felt like I was watching a good film as opposed to maybe a great film. The endless saga movies aren't usually my cup of tea, but when it got to the ball sequence, which takes up maybe the last, I don't know, last third or last chunk of the film.
I think it's about 45 minutes.
Okay, yeah, it's about, I guess, the last act, really. That's, for me, where the film really took flight, and I thought, like, the filmmaking in that section especially was really stunning. The main narrative almost falls away, and you get something that's a little bit more atmospheric, and the themes and ideas are conveyed a little bit more visually. You feel like Visconti's firing on all thrusters. So I thought that sequence was phenomenal, how much of it's told without dialogue, and just the physical acting, the dancing, I don't know, everything about it I thought was pitch perfect, and it felt enough like a microcosm of the entire film that I kind of thought if Visconti was maybe a little bit more radical in adapting the novel, the ballroom sequence could have been the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know, maybe that would have been the Alexander Sukharov version, I don't know. but I like the film. I think it's part of it that made it not feel tedious for me is just visually it's really interesting to look at. Like, you can see that Visconti has kind of a theater or opera background when you're watching it, because the framing's a little bit wide, and you have like even background characters that aren't really the main focus of the scene. They're always sort of doing something interesting that you can look at, the same way you would maybe look away from the main action once in a while when you're watching a play. It has that quality to it that I found really interesting. Like, it's not as extreme as Tati's playtime, but I thought a little bit of that while watching some of these scenes. You know, it's very detailed and very choreographed, but yeah, I liked it. That's the long rambling right. way to get there.
Liked it, didn't love all of it, loved some of it. All right, I think we know where you stand, Martin. Dave, how about you?
I'm kind of in a similar boat as Martin on this one. I've seen it a couple times now. The first time I saw it, I was like, this is movie that people talk about so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's objectively great. If you really, like, take a step back and look at it and be like, oh, look at the filmmaking, look at the colors.
It's glorious, handsome.
Technicolor.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a handsome film.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I'll also say, like, costume dramas aren't my fave.
Okay.
Maybe if this was set in space, it'd be so much more fun for me. But instead, we got 1860s Italy. And not to say that that's not interesting maybe to some people, but not my favorite.
Okay.
But I do think in rewatching it, there's a lot going on in the film that it can be appreciated, especially with those, like, intergenerational conflicts. Like, oh, these young people are going to try to jump in and take over and control things, but maybe they're just opportunists and it's just going to be the same, and maybe you're going to get some people that aren't really worthy of having power and control.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just know, kind of, if you know some history about Italy, kind of know that bad people do take over eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All yeah. their grandchildren are fascists.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of part of the painful pleasure of watching this movie is like it's all sort of ironic.
Mm-hmm.
But let me run this by you. I love costume dramas. It's like, that's maybe possibly my favorite of all genres. Yet something about this And as you both said, like, there's something, the movie is exquisite in its way, you know, like the period details are all beautifully rendered. And it doesn't make a point of really, kind of lingering on those details. It's sort of, it's just kind of there, and you really get a sense of these people's lived in spaces. And they inhabit them really well.
I'm going to say, yeah. I really appreciate production-wise.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dirty things in the film, like the wagons and the carriages. They don't look, like, immaculate.
Right.
And for a movie of this caliber, especially, like, it's an exquisite costume, handsome drama, to see, like, the streets being all dirty and to see that even the house he lives in is, like, not in the best shape. That's, right. That's a great detail.
Exactly, yeah. It's not like, you know, if you watch a BBC series, everything is perfectly placed just so, nothing is dirty, and no one looks comfortable. But this one, people do, they feel like I said, this is a place where someone could live. But I think maybe my sort of hesitation giving this a full-throated endorsement is just kind of my own personal reaction to watching this in this day and age. And maybe this is an overreaction on my part, but I'm not all that interested in the tears of a dying patriarch right now. I'm just not like, oh, isn't it a shame the aristocracy is crumbling? Like, I don't know. And I understand that what we're giving way to is something more dangerous, but like, I don't know. There was something about it that it wanted to have it both ways. Like, it really wanted to kind of bolster this leopard character as this figure of nobility and dignity, and kind of condemn, it seemed like it was condemning his children, or not his children, but, you know, his nephew, as who kind of is symbolic of the next generation. But I don't know, it didn't have a lot. I didn't feel like there was a really strong criticism of his character. I don't know. Do you guys disagree?
Well, I don't think it's as condemning of the young characters as it might first appear. And I know it's definitely different than the novel, which has like this extra section at the end where they do run it into the ground and become horrible people. I think, like, it doesn't see them really as bad people. I think it sees them as just mostly young and not caught up in this stiff aristocracy. Like, one of my favorite moments with Claudia Cardinale, or Cardinale, is when the Alain Delon character is telling this story and she just bursts out laughing. And it's such a... It's sort of refreshing, actually, like, hearing somebody, like, laugh naturally and not buttoned up by this formality completely, you know, and they all frown, of course, but like there is something sort of alive breaking into this world, which already feels in some ways very dead. Like, I think of that scene when they're, I guess it's Ash Wednesday, I don't know Christianity, but when they're, you know, the ash is on their face, and it's this long tracking shot of the family, and they already look like busts or statues, like they're already long dead, and they're, it's just like this, these ghosts waiting to happen, you know, especially like at the end, the ball sequence again, like I'm sort of in love with it. The busts of the Caesars, like Nero watching over this, like they're just waiting to join them. You know, like I did think a lot of Russian arc, like I think it's not necessarily critical of that class in the ways that, you know, the scathing critiques of other films might be, but I think it just understands that was an era and now it's over, and what comes might be better, might be worse, but something's going to be lost. I think that was sort of the takeaway. There's this feeling of, entropy being lost, the inevitability of it all, like the big dancing at the ballroom. Like, it starts off so energetic and beautiful, and by the end, everyone's just exhausted, and you feel it slowing down, and you feel the lights coming down, and it gets dimmer, and you feel like, in a way, that scene, it's the whole era just exhausting and coming to an end, and then him walking off, maybe not to die immediately, but you know, in a metaphorical sense, obviously, like walking into the dark, walking you know, into death, into history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I don't know, Dave, what was your reaction to The Leopard? What did you think of the kind of intergenerational struggle that was taking place?
I think it was pretty condemning of the younger people. Like, Alain Delon's character seems like a manipulator, opportunist. He's just going to side with whoever he thinks is most powerful. And you can see that from when he goes from, like, wearing, like, the rebel garb to, like, oh, I'm in the King's Army now. Mm-hmm. Those other guys. Yeah. I don't need them.
Yeah. There's still a bit of, like, Mr. Ripley, L.A. Delon is Mr. Ripley in Purple Noon. But, like, I mean, it's also the leopard himself. He's making deals to get money into the family. I think, like, maybe they're not as different as Lancaster character wishes they were.
I think that the Lancaster character kind of realizes that he's not that different either, because, like, I feel like he was a little duped into, because at the beginning of the movie he gives Alain Delon, because I'm not going to use any of the real characters' names, Tancredi's just like, I'm going to go join the rebellion, you know, I know it's going against the family, but I think it's what's best, if only we had money. And so and he uses the line, like, in order for things to stay the same, everything must change. And that kind of, like, really speaks to Burt Lancaster, because I think he kind of is like the people's prince, in a sense. Like, he likes the people, I assume, I don't know. And he wants to help them. But he also doesn't want to lose his station. And he thinks, like, if I'm in on this change from the beginning, I won't be ousted. I'll kind of be on top still. And that's exactly what Alain Delon wants to do. And I think that as he sees what Alain Delon's doing, he realizes, oh, I've been just as bad, and that's not who I thought I was.
Mm-mm. Yeah. I mean, is he just in denial? Or it's hard to kind of pinpoint what exactly how he sees himself. Like, what does he think he's losing, right? Is it this position in society, or sort of the ability to kind of hold yourself above the riffraff and be this kind of exalted figure?
Because he does turn down, like, the senatorship. He has basically a chance to stay in a position of power, and he turns it down. I think, and I mean, maybe he knows he's finished, or maybe there's some level of guilt.
I think by that point he has realized, like, oh, I'm not part of this world anymore. Mm-hmm. It'd be wrong of me to accept this. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the movie, Alain Delon's going to accept it. It's going to be his role. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you shouldn't do that. You're not part of this anymore. But he is. It's the people trying to... It's the jackals and the hyenas rather than the leopards and the lions, which... And it's like that line in itself just kind of has some weight into it. Just like, oh, the noble aristocrat. He's nice to everybody, so therefore he's better than you.
Right. Yeah.
Even though he's still a lion, they still eat the prey.
Exactly.
That's the kind of caveat of the film.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question, how do you think Visconti views The Leopard? What is he trying to portray in this character? Like, is this a lament about the dying aristocracy, or is it just kind of this is a thing that happened, or is it about the inevitability of this ruling class, be it an aristocratic ruling class, or whatever means it is, it is always going to be the haves and the takers and the taken or whatever.
I mean, I think Visconti sort of came from aristocratic background, or at least wealthy background, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, like, I think more than maybe the direct relevance of the politics, that there's something more about the nostalgia for this era. Like, it's a very nostalgic film. You get the sense that I don't know how much of it he's pulling from his own life or memories, but, like, it feels you know, are already a little bit prefated. I don't know how much of it's talking about aristocracy, or the haves and have nots in a totally contemporary sense. It's sort of longing for a time before hindsight. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
I think, like, Lancaster also mentioned that, like, he modeled his performance on Visconti, like, that aristocratic bearing. I think, like, you know, even if the character's not a direct representation of Visconti. Like, it's pretty close, I guess. It turned out that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the movie is, if nothing else, nostalgic for the trappings of the aristocracy. Like, I think that is beautifully rendered. And I mean, we did say, you know, it stuff is dirty, but it's also really lavish and inviting.
Yes.
So it's, in that regard, it is certainly a celebration of this lifestyle. 'Cause we don't really see what poverty looks like. It's mentioned in passing, and we get like little hints of it. And certainly the dead soldier at the beginning sticks out in your mind. But I don't know, as I was watching it, that image sort of recedes, and then all that I'm left with are like ball gowns and, you know,
and I think big it's giant a really, I think it's a really good juxtaposition, though, in the sense that, like, at the very end is him walking through, I assume it's a more impoverished area, because we kind of like see the shots like looking over the town, which doesn't, I mean, it looks nice, but it's dirty and grungy, and it's this aristocratic figure kind of like walking through it, like you said, kind of like a ghost in this ghost town in itself, because he's the only one out there. So you do kind of, I feel like you get a glimpse at least of something of the common man, maybe not extreme poverty, but something other than those ballrooms and those mansions and such.
Mm-hmm. Even the way it transitions to that final sequence, like I think he used a pretty long fade. So you get the sense that like these aristocrats, as they're walking off, as the party's done, they just sort of fade away. What's left is this emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's at the very least evocative, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we should probably talk about Burt Lancaster.
Probably. He's,
yeah, you know.
Is he in this film?
Yeah.
Didn't
believe
sound
it or not.
Like him.
Yeah, I know, right? I love him in this movie. Mm-hmm. This is my favorite Burt Lancaster performance. I don't know. I think it's so great how Visconti, he was not Visconti's initial choice, but I think it works perfectly as someone, as this character who's kind of straddling two different generations and not really fitting in either.
Right.
I think Lancaster's kind of the perfect person to play that part.
I mean, it's sort of like all my favorite Lancaster performances are like past his prime. Like it's similar to my favorite of his performances in The Swimmer, where it's this facade of dignity that is like gradually stripped away, but like coming out of classic Hollywood, he feels like somebody from a bygone age of maybe more dignity. It's in his cinematic aura, if there's such a thing. He just carries it with him, and even though like it's not his voice, the physicality of his performance I found really effective. Like the way he walks, the sort of look of exhaustion, the look of somebody who was athletic and is maybe just again like past their prime, or you know, scenes of watching him cry. There's something I think in his performance that you know, reminds you how little of great acting is saying lines. And even the film itself, like kind of coming at that point just before the new Hollywood, even though it's not a Hollywood film, it kind of made me think of how those languid epics that Hollywood was cranking out right towards that end of the era that were falling out of fashion. Like, it's funny that the advertising for The Leopard in America on the poster, it's comparing it to Cleopatra, which is sort of weird that even the film itself feels like it's part of this bygone age, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, it was co-produced by, like, 20th Century Fox. That's why they had to force an American actor in there.
Right.
Right.
They wanted to make sure it sold.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, I mean, it's really a stroke of genius. And, I mean, while great acting might not have anything to do with dialogue, I'm going to go ahead and say it has a lot to do with facial hair.
he rocks those mutton chops and
really mustache. Does. He looks fantastic. Really sells it.
It's almost like that facial hair carves this permanence. Like, even the eyebrows. It's like, there's this. He looks He almost looks like a cat.
He is the leopard.
He is the leopard. He just has this like permanent scowl. It's just like, I don't want to mess with that guy. Mm-hmm. But he's nice.
Yeah. He's still Burt Lancaster.
He is.
He can be... Burt Lancaster is so versatile, right? He can do cowboys. He can do scary dads. When was Sweet Smell of Success?
58.
Okay. Oh. Still a little bit younger there. Look at you calling that right up.
I love that movie.
Okay. That's a great movie. But he is such a... And this movie, you know, it makes such good use of his physicality. And especially in that ballroom sequence.
Like, there's something about watching, these lengthy sequences without any dialogue, without any real plot. It's just sort of mood and atmosphere and this kind of gradual modulation of them that I find really, I don't know, powerful, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the centerpiece of the film. And as you say, it totally encapsulates everything that the movie is about. And it kind of makes everything else... It makes a lot of the other scenes feel superfluous. Like they do a lot of talking in the other scenes.
Dialogue is kind of on the nose, yeah. I think. Like, yeah. I don't know how much of that has to do with the translation, but like a lot of it, like I don't know if it's like fair to say stuff could have been cut, but like to me now today it feels that way, that a lot of it was sort of unnecessary or kind of like it's sort of weird that the shots that I didn't think went on too long were just like endless scenes of people dancing, but you know, for me it was more like the dialogue, the kind of plotty stuff like that. I don't know, a lot of it just didn't feel really that essential. Mm-hmm. Maybe,
yeah.
It feels booky in a sense.
Yeah,
like, oh, he has to sit down and talk with this guy now. He is hunting buddy. Oh, mm-hmm. He's with the priest now. Mm-hmm. This scene, it's in the book. It has to be in here. But again, I don't really know the book. I don't know how faithfully adapted it is. The movie, though, does seem like it probably is making a lot of Italian students' book reports a lot easier.
Just curious, which version have you guys seen?
I watched the English one once and the Italian one once.
Okay.
Over a span of 7 years, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
It took you that long to watch it?
Yeah.
The American movie. Version's that yeah. long? And I've only seen the Italian version, okay. The 3 hour and 5 minute cut that's on the Criterion Blu-ray.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what... the original version was like 3.5 hours, right? And then Visconti did a cut, and that was eventually what got shown at Cannes. And then there was another American version, which
so
is
you're
shorter.
Saying is they need to keep going.
I'm thinking, yeah. Yeah, I think, honestly, if you watch the American version, there's nothing... I don't think there's anything you're going to miss.
I'd have to check that one out.
Yeah.
Because you get at the very least get Burt Lancaster's real voice in that
exactly,
one, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So, and I think that alone is worth it just to watch that. I guess we should talk about Alain Delon.
You guys were talking a little bit earlier. Like, do you think the character's kind of a sociopath? Or, like, I don't know. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of funny. He almost seems, like, too smart for that character. Like, there's the scene where he's watching the Burt Lancaster dancing with Claudia Cardinale. And, like, you almost feel like the emotion that the characters maybe meant to be portraying is like maybe some hint of jealousy or I don't know what, but like all that you can read on Alain Delon's face is just like calculation.
Yep.
It's
I have two things to say about Alain Delon's performance or the character in general. One, if this movie was set in the 1980s, he'd be wearing a popped polo shirt trying to shut down the ski resort. Two, this is something I kind of took in the second viewing, and it probably deals with Visconti himself, because correct me if I'm wrong, Visconti was gay. Is that correct?
Yeah.
At least secretly gay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I almost sense that there might have been something maybe inserted into the story by Visconti or in the direction that there's something between the uncle and the nephew, especially in the sense that Burt Lancaster's cat character, like, he seems to put all of his, like,
I wasn't going to say anything, but I think that's right. That's 100% right.
Like, clearly, like, his nephew is his favorite. He has seven kids of his own. Mm-hmm. One of them is a son, because obviously they're in a patriarchy, so his image is going to be carried down by a male character. And there is a little connection there. And I almost feel like Alain Delon's jealousy, in the sense that he's going to be dancing with his fiancée, mm-hmm. isn't that Burt Lancaster is dancing with his fiancée, yeah. but that his fiancée is dancing with Burt Lancaster.
Mm. Oh, this movie just got much more interesting. Ooh. I think you're right. That makes a lot of sense, especially given... have you seen Death in Venice?
I have not.
Yeah, so... yeah, I mean, we know... Like,
I watched it only knowing the title. Yeah. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Was there... spoilers, is there a death in Venice?
There, maybe. I don't want to give anything away. Okay. Yeah, okay. But there may or may not be. But there's also a...
he falls in love with a boy.
He falls in love with a very young boy. Yeah. So I think there's definitely something to that there. And now I'm trying to think, are there homoerotic undertones? I buy it. I definitely buy it.
I mean,
that makes sense.
Going back to like the Purple Noon, I think like I maybe like there is a lot of that character in. I'm actually not sure. I should have checked which one came first, but like he is a little bit like the Ripley,
mm-hmm. yeah,
Mr. Ripley in this. I keep thinking like that's sort of where, like it's not quite the gangster Alain Delon you see in later films yet, but it's there's something a little bit. People should watch.
No, I mean he's just so pretty. And also inscrutable. Like he is like so pretty it's annoying, you know? Like what cool. I don't know exactly how that relates to the larger themes of the movie, or if that's just a thing that exists, but it's just in short, I do think, I feel like that lends Delon's, Tancredi's character too much gravitas. Like, I think he is just like an 80s teen movie villain. I think you're right. I don't know. That was my takeaway. Like, he's sort of, he's just this like feckless brat, you know? Like, I think I'll go start a revolution or I'll be part of a revolution. Nah, never mind.
You know? If you Sicilians can't raise the 800 million to save your island, I'm going to come invade it.
Exactly. Yeah. but maybe that's why I think that's a fair critique given all that had happened in the early part of the 20th century. I think it makes sense that maybe one might be a little bit cynical about revolutions at that point. I don't know. But then again, Visconti was a communist. So I don't know.
It's hard to imagine a communist making this film.
Yeah, right?
I don't know what he was... I mean, like, I don't know if it was just, like, if it was fashionable to be... I don't know. I don't want to keep speculating. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, right? This movie is clearly very cynical about revolutions and the outcomes of revolution and the people involved in starting the revolution.
I wish more communists were cynical about starting revolutions.
Yeah, no, that would have been great. Yeah. Well, with that, I think I got to ask the last question. This is the 57th movie on the Sight and Sound list. It's 57th. What do you guys think? 50, is that too high, too low? Dave, let's start with you.
I'm going to say too high.
Yeah.
Too high, okay.
Even though I don't think it's a bad movie, like, that's really high up on the Sight and Sound list. Like,
isn't it?
If it's going to be on there, in my opinion, put it in, like, the late 100s, early 200s, maybe.
Yeah.
But I'd say this is a bit high for it.
Okay. All right. Martin?
Yeah, same feelings, exactly. Yeah. I'm surprised we made it through without talking about the election scene. But
I know. I mean, I think also that has really colored my viewing of this movie, and for better or for worse, I don't know. I think possibly for worse. Maybe I'm just like, I'm just so mad right now, I can't. I don't know. But I can come back to this movie later and see how I'm feeling. But, you know, apparently things never change, so who knows?
Who is the real leopard?
Exactly. All right, I think that's a good place to start. Our next topic is movies about changing tides and the conflicts that arise when different generations have to deal with each other's opposing points of view. We're going to talk about the ways that different filmmakers have addressed this issue, and we'll each list off a few of our personal favorites. But first, are there specific traits of kind of intergenerational movies that kind of make for really good movies like this? I'm thinking of like epic movies. These movies tend to have like a really big scope, or a lot of them do. Like, for instance, The Leopard, the movie we just talked about. But I'm wondering if there are any other traits that we can identify.
I think that when you're dealing with anything as big as like, you don't understand me, I don't understand you, especially just, it's something that everyone deals with because everyone has issues with their parents at some point. I'm sure every parent has had issues with their kids at some point. It's just something that's kind of innate to the human experience, especially in this day and age where literally the world I live in is completely different than the world my parents lived in. Maybe in like the 14th century, where everything was the same for centuries, it was not quite as vast of a change. But you'll have these things where, like, and I'm gonna just highlight one, like The Graduate. I know it's not a big scope movie, but you have the baby boomers generation with conflict with their parents because the world has changed so much for how they experience it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Martin, thoughts on different traits?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking like how many classic works of theater, like even going back before film, are sort of large scale stories about basically intergenerational conflict. You know, Shakespeare, like that's Hamlet and King Lear. Or going further back, you have Oedipus is sort of that, basically. You know, a young person trying to find their place in the world and sort of, well, you know, how that goes. A lot of the ones I thought of too were a little bit small scale. I think maybe that's the kind of film I might gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go big, like, you know, that's Star Wars before when you were saying you might like The Leopard better if it was in space, you know, that's the intergenerational conflict on the grand galactic scale, but
Darth Leopard.
Darth Leopard. <Yes. laughs> I'd watch that.
Elaine de Skywalker. Same movie, really.
Yeah, really.
Which is probably why I like Star Wars more.
Yeah. But, I mean, a lot of them, like, especially the ones that are like more from a younger person's point of view, they're generally like either coming of age stories or stories about rebellion in some way. So those tend to be more energetic than the kind of more novelistic, lethargic, and the young people are coming to get me. Yeah, I mean, there's a few that I think sort of find a balance really well, like I mean, a lot of Ozu's films, that sort of central theme of, you know, very delicately, artfully saying, you know, you kids are ungrateful. I mean, some of his later films, I think, like, are maybe more empathetic to younger people, like Ohio or Late Autumn, I guess, is the... Mm-hmm. I get them mixed up sometimes.
Late Spring, right?
Late Spring too. And Late Autumn are like the same movie, but one's in color.
Yeah.
Right. Or,
I think they're both great, yes, for the record. Yeah.
Have you seen the Satyajit? Oh, Jesus
Satyajit?
Christ. Satyajit Ray. Thank you.
Yeah.
Satyajit Ray film, the Music Room.
Yeah.
That one's amazing, I think. Like, as far as creating a sense of the time period, like a turn of the century, Bengal, where it's still lords, landlords who have a lot of power and they live this very aristocratic life. And I guess the plot in that film, his son dies and there's a sense that this is dying out, this whole way of life is about to die out, and it's sort of him putting on his last big show to impress people. But Just even visually, like the shots in that film where there's the famous shot with the elephant where you sort of feel like it's a way of life that's on the verge of dying out completely or disappearing. Or like Last Picture Show was probably another famous one that's intergenerational conflict, and it's not on a huge scale, but I mean, even that has like some qualities of an epic. I think just by evoking old Hollywood in the way that it does, it has like sort of a, I don't know, micro epic quality that I like about it.
Well, didn't Peter Bogdanovich specifically cited Magnificent Ambersons, I think.
That would make sense.
But that's a great one. That's like the perfect movie that symbolize what we're talking about here. But I don't know. Do you have a preference as far as like which side you prefer to hear from, the older or the younger? Like, do you like the movies that tend to be about like the older generation versus the younger generation?
I mean, I think, or as long as like there's some insight, I usually find it interesting. Like, I'll I mean, the film isn't very good, but like the play A Master Builder, I always thought was really interesting. The sort of way the older people in power try to hang on to it, even after they're overdue to be replaced. Like those kinds of stories, like, I do like, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, once in a while you run into something like there was that Ben Stiller film recently, While We're Young, which like I felt like borderline offended in its depiction of young people. but you know, like I think it has maybe more to do with just what insight the filmmakers are offering. You know, like sometimes they just seem to want to blame. But it depends on the film, I guess.
It depends on how well they're able to make their argument. Like, a lot of times, maybe because I'm young, I'll side with the young people, but then you'll get something like the work of Jacques Tati, and it's just like, you know what, maybe things were better before.
Right.
Like, maybe things are really stupid right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. I think there were definitely times in my life where I felt like I wanted to see the older people as more noble and, like, carrying great wisdom, but I don't know. I think it's funny how, as I'm getting older, I feel like maybe young people should speak up a bit. I don't know. Maybe it's because also, like, you mentioned The Graduate. Like, that movie's kind of insufferable.
Oh, I love it. I like that movie.
I mean, it's great. I love that movie. Don't get me wrong. But it's also kind of insufferable, right?
It's
What's that?
Oh, sorry. You keep going. I'll say after.
I mean, because it does... So posits the generation, it pits the generations against each other in this really kind of unfair way, right? But it's also
I don't care if the movie's fair.
Do you disagree?
As long as I like it.
Okay.
But it's not like always that common to see films that are really that sympathetic towards like young people, actually. Like, you know, there's a lot of pandering, but I mean, like, a film from this year I really liked was American Honey, and I was almost surprised how optimistic it was about millennials. You know, like, after hearing, like, so many people with who are older with fewer scars on their hands than me telling me how lazy I am, like, it was refreshing to see Andre Arnold kind of treat young people as capable and determined and motivated, and saying, like, you know, flaws notwithstanding, you know, we're gonna make it, we're gonna be okay. Like, it was actually uplifting for me.
Absolutely. Yeah I guess it's more you know, from The Graduate, I see the direct descendants as of The Graduate being stuff like John Hughes, which is kind to me the kind of the worst kind of youthful entitlement. But at the same time, I completely agree with you, Martin, in that, like, at this point, I would like to see young people stick up for themselves a little
bit more,
to be honest.
I feel like, I don't know, I guess I'm a Gen Y, millennial, whatever that would be. We hate each other. We hate ourselves as much as the old people hate us.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look at that millennial. But you're one. I think that's the biggest problem.
We dress in disguise as old people so they can't figure us out.
We're not one of those millennials, yeah. right? Yeah. No, we are.
You guys
like,
might
the
not
self-hating
be.
Generation. Yeah. We are. I think that does. That's totally us. We
no,
hate
we
ourselves. Oh, wow. Yeah.
We have a deep self-loathing. We love it, though.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's like also like directly connected with like a deep sense of entitlement, too. Like somehow those two are intertwined in a really ugly way, I think. Mm. That it's hard to unravel like where the like self-victimization and the entitlement and the self-loathing all sort of intersect, but there's got to be a place.
It all intersects yeah. in the fact that we all got trophies and hated that everyone else got a trophy too.
it all Stay. Intersects in Spring Breakers. It's
like, is it okay? But this—that's fascinating. So you do think we're entitled? That's fascinating.
Well, it's funny, like not to get like too far off topic, but like you know, we're part of a generation that's like simultaneously extremely entitled and is less likely to get the things that we want than the previous yeah. generation. Well, so it puts us in kind of a precarious position.
We were all told
think, like,
if you take out a massive yeah. loan, you'll get a great job.
Right. Yeah.
That's where everything kind of falls down. It's like, oh, you thought you were going to get a job. Yeah, that's what you told me I'd get.
Yeah.
Well, like, I was rewatching Spirited Away the other day, and it's totally, like, a film about millennials. It's, like, an early film about millennials. You know, really? That girl in it's like, oh, you're so lazy. And then she goes and gets a job and helps her pig parents. You know, it's sort of interesting to see, like, how our generation's being reflected on film, because it sort of is unfolding in a way that feels at least distinct. So artistically, yeah. at the very least, I think it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that I've seen a movie, at least a recent movie, that has accurately portrayed the sort of struggles of the millennial. I mean, I guess, you know, there's Lena Dunham, God bless her, but like she's coming from such a privileged position that I don't feel like we really get a sense of like what exactly it is that like the anxiety that of our generation like that. I feel like that's kind of the abiding emotion of our generation is just anxiety. You know,
that has not been well on film.
No, and also like so much of our lives, at least mine. I guess I should only speak for myself. It's like this. Yeah, overwhelming sense of like, I don't know if I'm ever going to make any kind of real money.
Well, it's interesting, like it's reflected in films that aren't necessarily about this time period specifically. Like, have you seen the movie Lore from
Lore?
A couple of years ago about the girl who's from the Nazi family immediately after the war ends, and she's been living in this bubble, sort of not questioning anything, and then all of a sudden she's left alone to look after her younger siblings, and she's supposed to go off and find her grandparents and, you know, get split off from her parents, and she sort of comes to recognize that the world is very different from this sort of sheltered, entitled place she grew up in, and it's sort of a I mean, there's so much anxiety in it, and there's so much of a feeling of the image of the world that she's developed being punctured and challenged constantly. And it's like it is specific to that time period, but it's interesting to connect that like to teenagers today, I think, in some ways. Yeah. You know, not to say like, oh, we're all the same as people coming out of Nazi Germany, but like it's interesting that the sort of films about young people that are being made right now, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess the one that comes to mind for me is Frances Ha, where it does sort of address her,
but
her, you know, career prospects.
But the whole point of the film is like, settle.
Yeah.
Give up your dreams.
Yeah, that is the whole point of
play that
dream.
Off
yeah,
like a happy
is,
ending.
Absolutely.
It's like, you'll never amount to anything. Happy ending.
But I found that comforting, and yet the message of the movie, the settle message, like, what if there's nothing to settle into, right? Like, right. Yeah, you're going to make a living as a choreographer? Really? I mean, like, the whole
thing... This is why, like, Neil Baumbach's
movies,
I sort of... I don't know, like, even the good ones, I'm not sure if I like.
Okay.
I think a big issue is just who's the one telling the story. If you have people that are older than us telling the story, then they're not going to get it right. And if the people telling the stories that were being seen aren't from a place of, like, if they're from a place of privilege, then they don't have the experience. And I kind of feel like,
right,
even though, yeah, it's easier now to make a movie than it's ever been before. I could do it on my cell phone if I wanted to. It might not look great, but it won't look horrible. But who's going to see it? And I kind of think that you need those connections. You need that networking. And it really helps to have money in general, anytime.
Yes.
Yeah. And our generation doesn't have that money to really get it there, get it made, get it out there. So you don't see that perspective as much.
Yeah. Right.
Have you seen the Mike Leigh film, All or Nothing?
I've not. I have not.
It's a little bit older, because it's also with Timothy Spall, and he plays a taxi driver, and it's almost saw it as a film, but like how family drags you down. Like, usually like family film, it's like meant to be uplifting, but like they have this overweight son who has a heart attack, and the couple are falling out of love, and it's almost like the feeling of hope that it might improve just makes it worse because they don't get out of it. But I don't know, that's a very good, very depressing film if you get a chance to see it.
All right. Check that one out. Yeah. Well, that's a good transition place. Should we talk about maybe our top five favorite movies about generational conflict?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Dave, you want to start us off?
Sure. Should I start at one or five?
Let's do five.
Five. Oh, goodness gracious. I'll go with number five. I'll go Late Spring. Yasujirō Ozu. Do you need me to talk about it at all, or should I just keep listening?
I mean, if you want more on Late Spring, there happens to be an excellent podcast you can listen to, turns out.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the name of this podcast?
You might be able to find it on our website, flickswise.com, under the episode guide. Just take a look.
Oh, really? I've not heard of this podcast.
Yeah.
All right, so five, Late Spring.
Okay, yeah.
Four. Oh, geez. I'll go with The Graduate.
Okay.
Three. I'm going to go with, because I think Wes Anderson tackles this a lot, I'm going to go with the one I think tackles it the best, Moonrise Kingdom.
Okay, interesting. Oh. Okay.
Two, Jacques Tati's Playtime.
Okay, great.
And number one, Empire Strikes Back.
All right. Martin, go ahead.
The Dance of Reality is a recent one, which I really, really liked. The Jodorowsky film, which sort of starts off like a surreal autobiography of him growing up in Chile as a child, but it gradually becomes more about his father and sort of who he was as a person, and maybe trying to kind of correct the relationship of the past, the intergenerational conflict through film, which I think was really interesting. You know, usually, like, I'm not for films which are the filmmakers doing their therapy on screen, but if it's Jodorowsky's mind, it's at least wild to be a part of that. And Edward Yang's films, like Yi, I guess, is probably the most obvious one, where it's not so much intergenerational conflict, but it's sort of interesting to see a specific moment in time. How much of that's present on this particular family and the way they all impact each other. I think that's a really interesting one. My friend Ivan Lapshin is a film I've just seen recently by Alexis Garin. And it's apparently, like, the censors said, like, you could touch, like, any other years, but not, like, 1934 and 35, because those were supposed to be, like, okay years in Russia's history, in the Soviet Union's history. But I guess it's also based on writings by his father, so it's sort of interesting to see how he kind of works through his father's memories, and there's definitely, like, simultaneously a sense of nostalgia and sense of doom and sort of a retrospective critique of the time period. It's a really, really great film, I think. I don't know, how many was that? Losing track. I wasn't prepared.
I think that was three.
Okay. American Pop is what really kind of impresses me about Ralph Bakshi's animated film American Pop is it's like a four generational story, history of counterculture and music, that's told in like less than 90 minutes. Like any other film, it should feel like completely cramped and disastrous, but like you really do get a sense of almost like a sense of continuum between these generations, how they're all pursuing a success in the music industry, and how they sort of try in different ways and fail in different ways, and all that leads up to the fourth generation finally succeeding. That's a really interesting film, because it almost treats this lineage, this family, as like a single character in its own way, trying to make it, which I don't know. I thought that was really interesting perspective. Mm. And East of Eden's one I really like, actually. Partly because, like, the first time I watched it, I hadn't read the book or anything, so I was like, oh, there's something wrong with that Jimmy Dean kid. He's gonna do something else. Like, and it's sort of about him kind of brushing off the father's expectations of him and what he thinks of him, and it challenges that. Like, it sort of challenged where I thought he was going as a character. And I think, like, Jimmy Dean, he's sort of, I guess, now recognized more as an icon than an actor. But I think, like, you can really tell in that film that maybe had he lived, he would have become something very interesting, I think. Or if he was already, he would have seen mm-hmm. that grow. But I like that film.
Yeah, I do too. I think that's a great one. Almost worthy of my list, in fact. But I have a couple of, like, things that don't quite fit this sort of nebulous category that we've just created. But I think we should talk. Someone should mention Gone with the Wind, because it's kind of the ultimate changing of generation thing. Like, your world has disappeared. What do you do now? And you mentioned Wes Anderson, Dave. I was thinking Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes,
That really
goes into, like, the times are a-changing. And I...
Exactly.
Maybe I probably should have put that one on my list instead, but my list is...
The end of a nondescript Central European era. It's...
But I don't know if either of those are exactly the... Because I don't know that there is all that much intergenerational conflict.
There's, like,
going
a definite,
on.
Like, kind of, like, Wilbur Smithy sort of, like, oh, it spans decades. And,
yeah.
Like, that kind of, like, novelistic... I mean, there's a few films.
Yeah.
That, I mean, they're usually, like, based on the novel and adapted by six writers, and they're usually boring.
Yeah. So
that's probably why we're not bringing them up as much, but, you know, it's definitely, like, a type of film.
Yeah.
And they're all very similar to
The Leopard.
But I think
those are two... Yeah. But I do think those are two excellent examples of that form. And we'll talk about both again later. I know we're talking about Gone with the Wind eventually. And Wes Anderson tends to come up on this show, so I'm sure we can go into more details on that later. But in the meantime, I think my top five, it's so, you know, the rankings aren't exact, but I'm going to go with number five, Shampoo. Oh. Hartley, or the, what's it, Al Ashby, movie with Warren Beatty. And, like, I like that movie because, like, there is this intergenerational conflict, but it doesn't pit the generations against each other exactly, or, like, there is some common humanity at the end.
I mean, it comes up also in the Harold and Maude. It's sort of...
Right.
Also in Hal Ashby's work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number four, Little Foxes, Betty Davis movie. Yeah. I like this movie because it has, like, that same scope of the best years of our lives. It's got the Greg Toland cinematography, so it's got this deep focus, and it feels grand, and it's like they're on this big... you know, southern plantation, and they're wheeling and dealing. But I like the depiction of this generation as being kind of greedy swindlers. There's no nobility in this lineage. You know, like, we're gonna take what we can get. We're gonna do what we need to do to survive. And I like the ruthlessness in which that's portrayed. I think it's more honest, which maybe that's, again, I'm in a weird place right now. So take that for what you will. Number three, Tokyo Story. if it could have been any number of Ozu films. Tokyo Story is pretty arbitrary. But it's his most famous. And again, if you want to hear more about Tokyo Story, there's a podcast you can listen to. In fact, there's a podcast you can listen to about Little Foxes. Number two.
Setting a trend here.
Yeah. number two, Meet Me in St. Louis, which isn't really, there isn't that much conflict going on. But it is that kind of the times they are changing kind of thing. And I like that there is family harmony, and yet they all have their different motivations. But it's also just delightful.
Also has the best snowman destruction scene ever put on film.
Yes. Oh, let us not discount that. and also a great bonfire and blessed flower throwing scene. A lot of great stuff in that movie.
Best trolley song.
Oh, yes. As long as we're handing out awards, yeah. And number one, I got to go with the Magnificent Ambersons, because this whole topic was an excuse to bring up the Magnificent Ambersons.
It really is sort of the ultimate version of the times are changing.
Yeah.
Generations are different story.
So that's my top five. But I guess listeners can tell us if we've missed anything, any obvious ones or not so obvious ones. All right, that's enough conflict for one show. Let us close things out with a few final notes of solidarity and togetherness. Martin, let's start with you. What's one movie, show, book, article, weather pattern, whatever, that you've been digging lately?
Well, I've been on a bit of a Hayao Miyazaki kick, so I've been reading a book called Starting Point, 1979 to 1996, which is basically just a collection of his writings translated into English, essays, letters, things like that. But it's very insightful. It's even got drawings and doodles. It's really cool. So I don't know if somebody likes the Studio Ghibli movies and maybe wants to know a little bit more about how they're made or what his perspective is. I think people should check that out.
All right. Love it. What's it called?
Starting Point.
Starting Point. Fantastic. All right. Dave, what you got?
I have a board game. It's called Secret Hitler. I'm going to try to make this sound not too much like a commercial. It's something that's new. It's from the people that did Cards Against Humanity, if you've ever played that. And if you've ever played the game Mafia as a kid, it's like Mafia, but with liberals and fascists and trying to enact policies and murder and, of course, Hitler. And you're trying to find out who amongst you is secretly Hitler.
Wow. He went there. Couldn't have been secretly Mussolini. Had to be Hitler.
Had to be Hitler. It had to be Hitler.
fair. Okay, well, that's awesome. I don't know if we've had a board game yet. This is great, actually. I love that.
I'm glad to be a trendsetter.
Yeah.
And it's a really great game in order to learn that you can't trust any of your friends because they're great liars.
Okay. I think I would fail at this game. I'm a terrible liar. But I guess I can try.
Should play with the leopard instead of Hitler.
Yes. the leopard. Okay, so for mine, I've watched three, in this week alone, I have watched at least three movies that I can recall that are almost 3 hours.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God.
So,
That's hurting my, sense of time and my free time.
Yeah.
Almost an out one. That's...
Yeah, I know. I watched The Leopard twice. I watched The Handmaiden, which isn't quite 3 hours. It's like 2 hours and 45 minutes. And I watched Barry Lyndon.
Oh.
Yeah. So now, I don't want to suggest that I didn't enjoy those movies, but, or that, you know, those 9-plus hours were a waste of my time. However, there's something to be said for a lean 90 or under movie. So today my positive note is basically thank God for shorter movies. And if you need a specific recommendation, I recently watched The Fitz by Anna Rose Holmer. It's her directorial debut. It's about a girl who joins a drill team, and then her teammates start coming down with a mysterious illness that causes convulsions. And the movie, it's only an hour and 12 minutes.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah. But within
don't
that
you just
time,
get so happy when you find a movie that's short? It's like, I could watch that right now.
Yes. Oh, it's so great.
Like my favorite movie ever made. It's like less than 80 minutes.
Yes.
So
yes,
refreshing.
Yes, indeed. Yes. But yeah, this movie, it's like it's about kind of a, I don't want to say, it's kind of an allegory about, you know, adolescence and conformity and how it may or may not be the worst thing in the world. But I thought it was pretty great. So check it out. It's on Amazon Prime. And if you haven't seen Barry Lyndon, you should also check that out because it's Israel Purdy. And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. Listeners, what's your take on the great Falconeri legacy? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com. And if you're down with modern times, you should probably follow us on the social medias. You can like us and leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. And you can find me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But most importantly, please go to iTunes or whatever app you're using to listen to us and rate us and leave us a nice comment. Help us survive into the next century. That's going to happen. Anyway, on our next show, we're going to bid adieu to this godforsaken year with a 2016 in review show. Expect lots of yelling and expletives or maybe just deafening silence. We shall see. Until then, Dave, thank you so much for joining us for the final Sight and Sound entry of 2016.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Ah, yes. And where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, geez. You can find me on Twitter at Cinema versus Dave. That's Cinema vs. Dave. And I have a blog that I don't update anymore. You can find
me
on Twitter.
Okay. How is the duel going, by the way?
Cinema's winning.
Okay, yeah.
But that's
always
good.
Does.
That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
I'll get them one day.
Yeah. Good luck with that. All right, and hopefully we can have you on again in the new year.
That'd be great.
All right, awesome. And Martin?
Lady P.
All right, let us continue on. Quiet dignity. Perfect posture.
I'm just going to waddle over here.
Yeah. Damn you! Damn you, Burt Lancaster! All right.